thanks so much for coming. It's so nice. It's like, you know, you're in a mature spiritual community when you say you're going to talk about morality and a lot of people come. Really, I mean, it's like, you know, we were in Búzios, Brazil speaking, and we did a couple workshops. We did like one on morality, and like our host came and like her grandmother, you know, and that was it. And then we did a meditation for drunks class, and the place was full. So it's nice to be in a kind of more mature community. All right, each week we have a word of the week. Anybody remember last week's word? It's a hard one.
Vigatabhaya.
Good, Vigatabhaya. What does it mean? It's a Sanskrit word. Yeah, to be without fear. So each week we do a word from one of the great three spiritual languages, Tibetan, Sanskrit, or Yiddish. So this week is a Yiddish word, and it's just a mensch. Does everybody know what a mensch is? We have a couple nods. Yeah. What's a mensch?
Can you spell it?
Yeah.
M-E-N?
You could spell it M-E-N-T-S-H. What's a mensch? What's that?
A real man.
Yeah, interesting. She said a real man. What? Anybody else? Anybody else have a definition? That's interesting.
As it was explained to me by a Jewish man, another man, he said, "You're a real mensch." And he asked, "What does that mean?" He said, "A man who holds everything in high esteem."
Yeah, beautiful.
You know,
yeah.
It
can actually be also it can also be a term for a woman or a child. It's usually a man, but it can be anybody, and it's just a very honorable person, totally authentic, a totally authentic person, somebody who's willing to help out at any moment. I love that it somehow got down to a real man. Because in a sense, that's what a real man is, you know? Somebody who is totally authentic and unafraid to help in any moment. So a beautiful word, right? And in a sense, related to the meditation we did, just the highest, kind of a high person, a person that you think highly of, that you want to be like. So last week we talked a little bit about some different meditation stuff, meditation posture, some ways to hold the body, and then what does Jay Tsongkhapa say is the only thing you really need in order to be able to meditate well? Does anybody remember? Jay Tsongkhapa, great Buddhist master, he says, you know, forget all the posture and the 8 points and this and that. You really only need to do this one thing in order to be able to meditate well. Does anybody remember what it is?
Not harming.
Yeah, he says ahimsa, really, to not harm. And a beautiful idea. I recently went to Mexico and I was walking on the beach and I came across a dying pelican that was being like eaten by crabs. But the pelican was still alive, you know? So I thought I would do hospice. Like I would just take the pelican into my hotel room. And pelicans are really big birds, you know? And I thought, you know, like it was just painful. And I know it's nature and like, you know, it unfolds in this beautiful way. But I thought like there was obvious suffering going on. And it was painful. So I wanted to minimize the suffering. And then I thought I'd take the dead carcass and then the crabs could eat it and, you know, everyone could be happy. But, so I wanted to minimize the suffering, right? So I tried to, as casually as I could, I mean, it's embarrassing to walk down the street with a pelican. But anyway, so I picked it up and I kind of like put a blanket over it so nobody would really know what I was carrying. But its like huge beak was sticking out and cars would drive by and they'd like see it and then, you know, slow down. And one guy even backed up and I was like, move along. But anyway, I get it back to my room and I was hoping, not in a mean way, but I was hoping to die within a couple hours so I wouldn't have to deal with it. And this was my first day in Mexico, and I was going to be there for, what, 12 days or something. Anyway, it lived for 30 days. So I had it for the entire 12 days, and then I pawned it off on a couple that was doing their honeymoon down there. And it eventually flew away. It eventually recovered. But I cared for this thing reluctantly and kind of begrudgingly, not like a mensch, but like a, kind of like a, you know, but I cared for it. And it turned out to be a hassle. Like, I had ants on it, so every day I showered with it. And I'm always trying to keep it hidden from the cleaning people. And one day it's in the shower, and I'm on the balcony just sunning off, and I left it in the shower, and the cleaning lady came in. And I'm like, oh God, here we go, you know? And I'm just trying to tell her there's a pelican in the shower. She doesn't speak English, so she eventually, like, walks in the shower and screams, you know? And I, like, give her a little backsheesh. I, like, give her a little bit of money and say, like, this is between you and I. But there was this, but, you know, I developed a fondness for the pelican, you know, and slowly I started feeding it sardines. And there was it was like a, almost like a child, you know. I was concerned about it, and I woke up concerned, and I developed a kind of care for it. And that's what ahimsa is. It's not harming, right? But it's where you have a where you begin to care for the world, where you start to, at your inconvenience sometimes, right? You start to take care of the world. You start to look out for beings. My mind was slightly agitated, so I was just kind of hoping it would die, you know? But like with a proper state of mind, right? With patience, and with compassion, you just gently watch out for the world. And again, at your inconvenience, which oftentimes in the moment seems like it's at your inconvenience, right? But I was going through a particularly difficult emotional time then, and it turned out the pelican was really quite healing for me. You know, so oftentimes when you care for the world, when you seem like you're inconvenienced by another suffering and you decide to care for it, it oftentimes is you the one that's being nursed back to health. And you've all have had that experience, I'm sure. So ahimsa is really this idea, right, of taking the pelican in, washing the ants off, gently, you know, feeding it, making sure it's safe from cleaning ladies and stuff like that. Just gently caring for the world. And interesting, right, that is the way to have good meditations. That's the way to have a clear mind, to be able to focus clearly. It's not so much about posture or how well you've studied. It's an attitude of watching out for beings in the world. So, in every spiritual tradition, they've given us these codes to live by. I was just reading, and now I forget the name of it, but there are these huge columns that were put up, I want to say in... I believe in Kansas. If anybody's heard of this, let me know. But they're giant, 16 foot high, 6 foot wide. There's 5 giant granite columns.
Georgia.
In Georgia, yeah. And they have a code of ethics. And they were put, the land was bought, the columns were paid for at a huge expense by an anonymous figure. Nobody knows who it is. And they wrote these code of ethics in all these different languages, Sanskrit, Swahili, English, Spanish, French, all these different languages, these 10 code of ethics. And they're really interesting. They're unlike most code of ethics you've ever heard. But every tradition has these code of ethics, right? Ashoka, the great king of India, wrote them on pillars and put them all throughout the country, these different code of ethics about ahimsa, about not harming. And oftentimes I think about code of ethics as something that I have to take up to be a better person, like something I have to be better at, like my times tables, you know, like something I should memorize and, all right, 4 times 8, like I should just have it, I need to work harder at it. And when you start to really read the masters, there's an idea that the code of ethics are just a way for us, there's like a luminosity that we're not able to see. there's like a luminosity that our mind is covering up with obscurations. And the other morning, we were out working on our retreat cabins, and I got up at 4 in the morning, and it was a full moon. And the full moon at 4 in the morning, like there's just a hint of dawn. There's a hint of dawn in the air. And it's a brightness like no other brightness, you know, just that full moon just coming right down on the horizon, a hint of dawn to like color it. And it's this kind of luminosity, right? And you see a lot in the Eastern traditions, they talk about enlightenment as a full moon. It's this kind of brightness, this kind of luminosity. There's a kind of luminosity that if you taste it, you'll become dissatisfied with everything else. And that's really the heart of what they call renunciation. But it's not, renunciation is not like giving up on something. It's just experiencing something something more beautiful that you become less interested in lesser things. You see what I mean? And again, I always use the example of ninja supplies. Like when I was 14, I loved ninja stuff, like throwing stars and nunchucks and stuff. And I didn't have to renounce that interest, right? I didn't have to resist being interested in that. I just got interested in something more beautiful, which for me at that time was girls. Right, so like girls came into my life, and I suddenly like ninja supplies were not interesting. You see what I mean? It's a very natural progression. I was uninterested in nunchucks, you know. I wanted to like talk to Alex Brady, you know, the girl that lived next door. Like I, you know, so it's a natural progression. So as you clean the heart through these, through this system of the yamas and niyamas, you actually lose interest, you experience more pleasure, you experience more beauty, and because of that, you lose interest in things that don't create beauty in your life. So, right, we talked about yoga, citta, vritti, nirodha. Yoga is stopping how the mind turns things around. You can also think of the chittam as like this luminosity, right? And virti, and we've talked about this before, perverted, vortex, vine. These are the words that we have in English that come from the same European root. Virti means to twist, to obscure. So anything that we have in our mental consciousness, right, that covers over that luminosity. That covers over that luminosity. All that's doing is it's limiting your capacity to experience real pleasure. It's limiting your capacity to experience real joy. I was just reading the other day Simon Tugwell, who's a beautiful Dominican monk and also a great author, and he says this, the most typical evidence of grace being at work in us is not that we find ourselves aware of a duty, but that we find ourselves aware of a desire. And we can change the language too and say that when the yamas and niyamas begin, when we begin to practice them, right, it's not so much a duty, but it's an increased level of desire. What we're talking about is increasing our desire for beauty, our desire for awakening. And in so many ways, we diminish that in ours. Every time I want to suggest that we turn on the TV, it's a way of lessening our desire. It's a way of kind of verting our chittam. It's a way of obscuring our vision. It's a way of diminishing our capacity. When you think about the capacity of the mind, it's incredible, right? And for different reasons, we obscure that. And so the yamas and niyamas are just this beautiful way of gently opening that path of back up to us. And I think many of us, especially when we were children, had experiences of that immense luminosity, experiences of that really deep beauty. And there's a pain that's in the beauty. I heard This American Life did a story on camp. And they were talking to these kids that went to a religious camp. And they had such deep, profound experiences at camp. And when they came back, it was so ordinary, you know, like life was so like back to the mundane. And one girl that they were interviewing, she was like 15, she said, I hope I never experience anything that beautiful again because the pain of the loss of it was worse, you know. And in a sense, that's why it takes courage to experience beauty. It's a weird concept, but it takes courage to desire deeply. It takes courage to desire deeply. And if we don't have that courage, the yamas and the niyamas just gently awaken that desire in us. Because they just gently awaken the desire in our hearts. So it's very beautiful. So don't think about it so much as morality to do and duty. It's this awakening that can happen in your heart. And they almost always start with ahimsa, with starting to want to take care of the world, starting to want to waking up and just having that gentle feeling of taking care of the world. And you know, with the pelican, it's easy. Sometimes it's almost easier with animals, right, than with people. Because we don't, like, I don't know if the pelican was annoying to other pelicans, you know? Like, I don't know if the pelican had an annoying voice and was, like, really demanding and always complaining. You know, like, I just saw this, like, innocent creature, right? But with people, it's harder sometimes, you know? But what if we could wake up and see, we live across from a puppy, and so we wake up and we see this puppy, and he's just, like, I think he's maybe not cared for so much. And he's just always like the fence, like just wanting love, you know? And it's so easy to open your heart to that. But how could we see the people in our office in that same way, right? The people that need our attention. And I talked about a couple weeks ago, and I want to reiterate, and I've been exploring it, and I still hold to my conviction that everybody has a subtle level of anxiety. Everybody has this kind of base level of anxiety. And we always are in an opportunity to diminish people's anxiety. I work at a restaurant, and I don't know why, but for some reason you can really see it when people come to eat. There's this weird anxiety when we come to eat. Maybe it's some deep thing, like we're worried we're not going to get enough, you know, or something like, get away from my, you know, carcass, like this is mine, you know, some like some deep-rooted fear. But there's this subtle level of anxiety. So my job, really, in working in a restaurant is to just gently try to diminish, reduce people's anxiety. You just have to reassure people, right? Like in subtle, I don't tell them, like, don't worry. You're going to be fed, you know, everything's going to be okay. But it's amazing. And those of you that have worked in restaurants, you know psychologically there's such a distinct difference between when somebody leaves and when they come into the restaurant. There's just a kind of anxiety. So we have that, we're in a position, you know, because we oftentimes think, like, I think, like, well, what can I do for people? You know, like a pelican, I can put it and take it home, right? But what can I do for a person? It feels so helpless. Like, how can I help people? How can I apply ahimsa to people? It feels so hopeless sometimes, right? But we can always help reduce people's anxiety. And in the very least, don't contribute to their anxiety, right? Which I do all the time on purpose, because that's how twisted my mind is, right? You know, I'll see somebody that's a little bit anxious and I'll just needle them, unconsciously but on purpose, okay? Everybody with me? Unconsciously but on purpose. And then I catch myself later, I'm like, I'm so sick, why, you know, why do I do that? And the more you can catch it, the less you'll do it, right? But you know, and it's just some weird, it's a unhealthiness. And really, I'm not affecting them so much. All I'm doing is I'm verting my chittam, right? I'm obscuring my vision of luminosity. When I you know, engage in gossip, or when I try to get somebody's mind anxious, for whatever reason, whatever sick reason we as a culture, as a race, do that, the only thing I'm doing is that I'm limiting my capacity for joy. I'm limiting my capacity for pleasure. So in that context, we can take guilt out of the equation. We can take, like, I'm such a bad person, I can't believe I just did that. You know, I'm horrible. No, it's like, oh, all I've done is I've just limited my capacity for joy. You see, it's a subtle distinction, but if you want to progress on the path, it's important to remove guilt from the scenario because it's not serving you, you know. So in the yogic tradition, right, they go through what's called the yamas. And the very first of the yamas is the non-harming, right? Ahimsa. Himsa meaning to harm, and the ah before it meaning the opposite of it, really. So to care for or to watch out for. The next one is satya. And I'm driving all the time these days, so I'm listening to like podcasts, and I just listen to a lot of stories and stuff. And I heard a story the other day on this guy asked a group of people, if they could be invisible or fly, which one would they want to be? And then he just interviews them. And here's what you got, like over and over, you got these things about, well, if I was invisible, one guy was like, I could watch different women shower naked, and I could go into changing rooms at the mall. And then another guy was like, I could bypass the traffic. You know, if I could fly, I could just, like, you know, bypass traffic. And, you know, it was over and over. One guy said I wouldn't have to pay for the bus. Now, let me break it down for a minute. We're talking about incredible superpowers. And people are like, the first thing that comes to their mind, which is really our minds, right, is save $1.25. Wow, if I could fly, I could save $1.25 every day. You know, that's a mind that is not in luminous, right? That's a non-luminous mind. That's the kind of mind that's on primetime television, right? That's just a non-luminous mind. But something occurs to you as you listen to this program, and he interviews like 20, 30 people. No one says, I would use that to help humanity. Nobody says, I would use that to fight crime. Except for one guy. He says, you know, you could fight crime, but that's really dangerous. He goes, because if you had one of those superpowers, you would be limited, because you don't have invincibility, right? And you don't have, like, weapons. You just have the ability to fly, so you could still get pretty harmed. He said, so I would probably stay away from crime fighting altogether. And just, you know, so it's like, what would we do with our superpowers, right? What would we do with our superpowers if we had one? And we have the superpower of speech, right? And satya is truthfulness, is not lying, right? And we have that superpower of speech. We have the superpower of telling the truth. And how often do we use it? You see what I mean? We don't think of it as a superpower because we're so accustomed to it. If we lived on another planet where everybody flew, we would just take it for granted. And we would be concerned with saving bus fare. But us, if we said, imagine you could fly, we would just immediately go to all the possibilities. But what if I said, imagine if you had the power of communication and speech? You're like, yeah. Yeah. But you can use it for incredible things, right? You can use the power of truth. You can use non-lying to accomplish incredible things in the world. And we'll just end. I just was in, I think it was in Houston Airport. And I just had a quick change between flights, and so I went to, like, the taco place. And there I met Jeffrey, right? And Jeffrey was, like, a 35-year-old guy who was like a saint. I mean, I already, like, talk about diminishing anxiety. By the time I got close to the counter, I didn't want to leave the counter. He didn't even talk to me yet, right? And there was just such a power, energetic power. And he turned to me, and with this presence, with this authenticity, he said, and what would they call you? What's your name? And I said, Will. He's like, well, all right, Mr. Will. All right. What are we gonna do for you here? Well, how are we gonna serve you here? You know, and it's just this, like, this quality. And I was like, oh man, like, it just put my heart so at ease. And I noticed something happen, which is going to sound totally absurd. But so anyway, I ordered, and Jeffrey and I had a little conversation. And as I'm walking away, I'm catching my next flight. Very subtly in my awareness, I had this thought process. And the thought process was, you know, I'm going away on retreat, so I'm like thinking about saying goodbye to people, right? And I'm like, holy shit, I'm not going to see Jeffrey again. I've got to go back and say goodbye. But it was very subtle, you know what I mean? Wow. And then it occurred to me, I don't even know the guy. Like, of course I'm not going to see him again. But the thought process was like, I'm not going to see him for 3.5 years. Like, I've got to go back and make a connection, you know? But and obviously it was so absurd because, of course, I'm not going to see him in 3.5 years. I'm not going to see him ever again in my life. Do you know what I mean? But he had such a power through his speech that he immediately, I felt like he was family. I had this really strong feeling that this was somebody that loved me and that I loved deeply. All through just the power of speech, the power of presence, right? And that's a power that we all have. And how are we using it? In what ways are we using that power? So over the next couple of weeks, we're just going to slowly think about these different spiritual powers that we have. We're going to look at them and break them down like they do in Ashtanga, right? The 8 limbs of yoga. The path to enlightenment. So it starts with ahimsa. And then the next one is satya, truthfulness. And they go in order. There's a reason for the order. There's a power to the order, and we'll look at that. And then we'll break it out a little bit into real life. Is there ever a place to lie? Can you lie with ahimsa? Do you assume? If ahimsa is the foundational quality, if ahimsa is the foundation, and satya lies under that, is it ever appropriate to lie if ahimsa is guiding you? Do you see? So let's leave it at that. We'll think about that. We'll come back to that next week. Thank you so much for coming and being interested in these ideas. If you're going to yoga now, enjoy.